Hello and welcome to the Dear InfoSec podcast from the Information Security Forum. In this episode, you will step into the near future and perhaps learn how to cope with the uncertain times in which we find ourselves. And now, on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Dear InfoSec podcast, where we talk about, tackle and even solve some of the many, many problems that practitioners confront every day. So if you have a problem and need some help, get in touch at dearinfosec@securityforum.org and we'll assemble a team of experts to look into it and advise. Today's episode is all about possible futures of the internet and the web, the place where we all live now. Just thinking about how fast that technology has become the bedrock of pretty much everything we do. That CrowdStrike issue that hit the world a while ago certainly underlined that dependencies we have, and I'm sure it's going to change us in all kinds of ways in the near future. And we're looking into that near future because we are drawing on some work by the organization that oversees Australia's net domain, the .au domain, that's AUDA. It ran a scenario generation exercise very similar to the ones we do for Threat Horizon, looking at plausible futures for the net as a whole and how that might shape the way we live. Really fascinating work. We'll make the links available so you can have a look, dig into the detail. Some really interesting conclusions, well, not conclusions, some interesting ideas, certainly got me thinking. But here to talk about that work is Sophie Mitchell, Chief Communications Officer at AUDA. Hello, Sophie.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, good to have you here. It's truly international as well. We've done quite a lot of these recordings. So whereabouts in Australia are you?
AUDA is based down in Melbourne in the south of Australia.
Excellent. Yeah, good to have you. And just a quick question to locate you in the sort of nets and the web's history. When did you first become aware of the net and the web, and which was the first browser you used?
Oh, gosh. My memory extends all the way back to the 90s, I think, was really when I became aware of the web. It was really when I was in university that it became a tool people spoke about. But of course, you had to go to the library to access the one computer that could connect you to it. And it was really only used for email in those days. And it wasn't until I started my first corporate job where while we still might have had access to a typing pool, we did all have computers and use the internet from time to time. And you've asked about the first browser, and I did have to cast my mind back. First, I remember the logo on my desktop, and it was Netscape, which, of course, lost the browser war, but yeah. I still remember it.
Yeah, Netscape Navigator. I think my first browser I used was Mosaic, because I had a friend who was a developer, and so he was using it at work. And we did spend most of a weekend just browsing the internet and going, wow, look, he can see things about all kinds of stuff. Just, you know, fairly dull, but, you know, astonishing. Because the internet was something you went to, wasn't it, at that point? It wasn't something that was just there in the background of everything we do.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Also here is Matt Finch. I think you've been on this podcast a couple of times, Matt. Matt is from Oxford Side School and spends more time in the future than anyone else, thinking about the future than anyone else I know. So, yeah, Matt, are you really clued up about the future? Are you building a bunker, stockpiling champagne?
It's lovely to be with you both. I'm not currently building a bunker. I think it's less about living in the future than living with uncertainty, which is that strange mix of anxiety and doubt, but also hope that things could be other than they are. And so that creates a very strange take on the world sometimes where you look at it and think all of this stuff is more mutable than we think. And then sometimes less surprising, you know, the changes don't come when we expect. So maybe I'm, yeah, wandering lonely as a cloud, like sort of Wordsworthian poet, but not presuming to know where the clouds are going next.
No, indeed. Yeah. Who wouldn't want some more poetry on the Dear InfoSec podcast? I think we should maybe have a poetry corner every now and again. But yeah, but Matt, I don't know, I'm making some assumptions here, but you're a bit younger than me. So what was your first experience of the web? Was it MySpace or something like that? Or Dig? Or I don't know.
Do you know, I'm one of those lovely people who's exactly on the cusp of Generation X and Millennial. And therefore, the very tail end of high school, Netscape Navigator, email address, definitely going straight into the MySpace generation, but I'm such a turn of the millennium kid. So weirdly, the first thing I remember doing, interestingly, with the internet was I got a school email address that would let me email externally. And of all the bizarre things to do, I emailed an art cinema that was like the local cinema that showed odd movies. And I'd heard about this movie coming in like 1998 called I Know What You Did Last Summer, which of course is just a slasher movie teen flick.
But
at this time it hadn't come out yet. And it sounded like it might be this art movie about these teens who are like haunted by the loss of one of their friends and all this. So I'm emailing Nazi, like, is this movie an art movie or is it like a slasher film?
Wow.
And they emailed me back saying, listen, it's just going to be in all the multiplexes. Very strangely, that was my really first use of the internet, was to try and get access to movie news early, but by emailing spurious questions to an art house.
Great that they responded as well, though. Wow. Yeah, did you see the movie? Were you deeply disappointed that there wasn't more anguished teens in there?
Well, funnily enough, the thing that happens, I think, is we watch movies and we project our own feelings onto them. So I watched it and was like, this is a trashy movie. But the movie in my mind was better than the movie I was watching.
You should write the screenplay for that.
Yeah, exactly. The ways that we fill things out with our own imaginations, which is also like scenarios work. I love the way that you even quite hollow things with a lot of meaning sometimes, like pop songs.
Yeah, well, I think that's what the great things about scenarios is, that it does play on some of those very human attributes, doesn't it? Sort of people ponder, they think, they speculate, they, you know, and it's that creativity that's latent in a lot of people, just the way you think about the world daily. I wonder if or that might happen, and some of those thoughts are quite weird and strange and random, but I think that's part of the what galvanizes people when they do scenarios. Don't know, Sophie, if you found that sort of that creativity really sort of came to the fore, because certainly reading those scenarios, they were very provocative. They just, you know, had lots of novel thoughts in there.
Thanks, Mark. We had such fun creating them, and that was both the outer team who really came together and pondered deeply what the future might look like. But then, of course, while we threw lots of ideas at the wall, we then gathered a large range of external stakeholders from a range of industries. And that was equally powerful just to get their insights. And you're right, the creativity, the buzz in the room was so lovely to see, because it's not often you're asked or you get to spend time in your day job to do that. So really eternally grateful for both the team and those external stakeholders who came and helped us. It was a great lot of fun, and I'm glad you say that comes out in the scenarios.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's some, I mean, they definitely, because one of the ways we use them is to explore some of those extremes, some of those sort of poles of, you know, the way things could go. But I don't know, Matt, do you always find, I think we've talked about this before, the sort of storytelling aspect of it is really useful. And I did, is that, but as well as that luxury of creativity, because I think Sophie's right that in a lot of people's jobs, they just don't get to do that very often.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of systemic thinking and storytelling. So it's a chance to look beyond our own role in a given system, but then almost imagine, what if those roles were recast? What story is going to unfold around us? And it is playful and it is poetic, but it's strategically consequential, because what you're doing is you're thinking outside of your normal frame of reference. You're giving yourself license to let go of assuming the world is always going to be the same chess game with the same pieces, the same moves, and the same objectives. And the delight of the work is that it is playful and creative, and people get to say, what if things were different? And it's also where the anxiety is of, oh heavens, what if the world is going to be different and I have to play a different game? And I think the sweet spot is this sense of play, but play with consequence. And you know, you hear this term sometimes, serious play. Finding your way into that groove, which I think Outer did, and did a good job of bringing in public officials, representatives of big tech, representatives of nonprofits, getting people who might not even agree on what the future should be or what's going on around us today, and saying, let's play things out. Let's play contemporary uncertainties out into the future. That was what the process seemed like from my perspective.
Yeah, and I think certainly having read quite a bit of sci-fi, and for a long time I did think, oh, science fiction is all about the future, isn't it? And it's not, absolutely it's not. It's about, like you say, it's contemporary anxieties and sort of trying to extrapolate those. And I guess, I mean, Sophie, that certainly seemed to capture a lot of that in those scenarios, that there was some contemporary anxieties being definitely explored. Some of them, some of those scenarios you came up with, are some of them aren't great places to live.
Look, I think that's right. And I think, I mean, you do, when you lean into the future, you think about those concerns that are most pressing today. So I think we did certainly lead with those, but I did love seeing how people extended them. And you're right, some of those scenarios are a little grim, or a little dystopian. And indeed, in one of our first iterations, we really did say, you know, we need to go back to the drawing board. Perhaps we're actually thinking, yes, looking at the future as if it's too dark. And from that came the ecological civilization scenario, where we really did want to inject some hope in about the future. Of course, there is hope, and the future will doubtless have shades of light and dark. So I hope that comes through in all of them. And I think, you know, every future scenario, just like our day-to-day living, has challenges and opportunities, and it's about how they're harnessed.
Definitely. Yeah. I think so. The three scenarios you came up with was the ecological civilization one, which is very much about sort of reacting to what climate change is doing to the world. Then state of alert, which is about geopolitical tensions causing just all kinds of consequences, and people sort of becoming giving service and gaining social credits from governments, a very fragmented internet in that one. And then the final one, Price is Right, which is rampant corporations and profit. It doesn't quite rule, but it definitely drives a lot of those larger organizations to take the place of governments and things. So, I would encourage people to, we'll make the links available, encourage people to read into those. But it was that, I'm curious about how it's going to change what Audit does. I mean, is it, and I guess the reason for doing the scenarios is to sort of prepare for those futures. So, yeah, is the strategy work that since it's followed on from this as well?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. And you're exactly right. So ADA is just coming to the end of its current corporate strategy, which is a five-year strategy. So we knew that in coming to our next strategy, that we would really have to think even more deeply about the future. Of course, when you work in technology, you're always thinking about the pace of change, and there's a lot of emerging technology that's changing what we do day to day. And so we were acutely aware that our future is going to be quite different from our current, and certainly very different from our past. But we knew we didn't just want to iterate that our current strategy by a little bit, you know, just tweak it around the edges. And our CEO, Rosemary Sinclair, was absolutely certain she wanted to take an approach with scenarios and do some foresight work. And she had, as luck would have it, worked with Matt Finch in the past. So we were absolutely delighted to connect with Matt again and have him support us in this project. But that was definitely the lens through which we approached it. And we hope, of course, now we've done it, we are spending a lot of time internally, both with our staff and with our board and, of course, our stakeholders as well, discussing the scenarios, their plausibility, what those opportunities are for ADA and for the industry, really. We do see them as a piece of work that the communications industry and certainly the domain name industry can perhaps, you know, potentially take and think about what their future looks like as well.
Yeah, because I think what I really liked about them was just that assumption that, you know, like you said, the internet is just there and it's just powering pretty much everything. And I think there is a Bill Gates quote about sort of overestimating the influence of technology in 1 year and underestimating what it can do in 10 years. And you looked out to sort of 2044, I think. So, yeah, the sort of profound impact it can have. But I don't know, Matt, across the scenario work you've done, is there common things you see coming out of this? I just in terms of how people should prepare or how things are going to change? Quite a big question, I know, but...
I think about your opening words for this episode, and you talked about the idea of tackling the problems of the day. And in a way, it's about getting a handle on what's going on around us. So in the same way that contemporary sci-fi and contemporary scenarios are being made by the same society, so they contain the same anxieties, same concerns, we're looking at the same things. I can see that a lot of it, people are often coming back to the question of what values will orchestrate and dominate and structure and flavor the systems we inhabit in times to come. Is it going to be that the pursuit of profit and the power of private actors is really going to be the driving systemic force in global governance, in international interactions? Are we going to see a return to national security being a priority given the conflicts that are very evident in the world right now and some which might still be brewing up? Is it the case that actually our response to climate change is going to have to dominate our policy choices, our choices as a society? I think one thing about the three outer scenarios is actually, for example, climate change is in all three of them. It's really about the values that the world chooses to live by in response to that, which is the issue. And I was thinking about what you were saying about hope and scenarios you want to live in. You know, we look around us in the present day. In the UK during the pandemic, there was a scheme called Everyone In during the COVID lockdowns, which ended homelessness in the UK for about a year. You know, we got everyone off the streets, and the Lancet, the medical journal, said we probably stopped 21,000 infections. We probably saved more than 250 lives, but the scheme didn't even finish the year that it ran in. So it's a bit like the old John Lennon, war is over if you want it. Our present day is a mixture of light and dark with some really dark elements in it. And each of those scenarios just shows a different mix of sunshine and clouds, precisely so we can say, you know, we'd like to believe we're going to live in utopia, or we'd like to believe we're going to do the right thing, but probably the future is going to have compromise in it, hypocrisy, grey areas, challenges. And to me, I see a lot of different organisations and communities wrestling with things. But I think that fundamental element under each of the three outer scenarios is interesting for all of us. You know, is it profit? Is it protecting the ecosystems that keep us alive? Is it our own national security? And the answer might not be a clean or tidy one.
No, I think you're right. I suppose I've often seen scenarios as disconnected from now. In some respects, sort of that there is a sort of rift between where you are now and what you think might, you know, those plausible possibilities you explore, but actually they're directly connected. I don't know, Sophie, you sort of that came out from this. I think, you know, Matt's right in terms of the values, and I guess that's part of the strategy, isn't it? Sort of finding out what matters and what you have to respect and what you have to try and preserve as well.
Yeah, that's right. And as I said, it's still a very much a live conversation within Outer, but I think hearing from all of our stakeholders and as Matt articulated, that sort of the climate change being one of those core concerns that actually runs as a theme through all of the scenarios, even though it takes a more prominent role in one of them. You know, I think Outer is really starting to think about how environment and sustainability is a part of its future. I also think the other tension, which was obviously about technological advancements, and digital identity and identity management, is another really key area for Outer and how we ensure that our online identities are trusted into the future. And then I think it's also that sort of governance and global governance and trust and control there. But I think Outer, we already play a large role in terms of engaging globally around matters of internet governance. But I think ensuring that we maintain and build that global engagement to ensure the underlying infrastructure of the internet is so critical to ensure that regardless of what happens in, you know, with global tensions in the world in the future, that the internet can continue to be interoperable so that people can continue to benefit from it.
Yeah, because I think Australia is in a sort of interesting place, isn't it? Because obviously climate change is a reality, wildfires and things like that. Whereas in the UK, people think about climate change, great, it's going to get warmer, less rain, hurrah, nicer weekends and better weather. But there's a reality there that, you know, a lot of the rest of the world is suffering as a result of that. Sorry, Matt, I interrupted you.
No, not at all. Let's build off that. I think precisely that notion, though, it's particularly in the ecological civilization scenario, it's the notion of systemic collapse. Like the notion that globally the climate is changing in the ways that no one can pretend it's not going to reach them because climate doesn't respect national borders. But there's something else to this idea of actually we're really wrestling with the problems of the present. You know, when you talked about the Bill Gates line, I was thinking about, there's an economist called Rüdiger Dornbusch who says crises happen little by little, but all at once. So they come slower than you think and then faster than you expected. So you have the opportunity to be wrong twice, which I love. But actually, when you look at the governance of the internet, you look at the role that ICANN has had and the unusual history which allowed ICANN to exist. You look at those forces that would prefer the internet to be managed through the International Telecommunications Union. You look at the possibility of novel things, disruptions, splinter nets with drawbridges that connect. And all that stuff is around us now. It's not just a 20-year horizon. It's a current political issue. And for InfoSec practitioners who are busy just trying to protect their institutions from breaches or dealing with things like CrowdStrike and updates falling over, actually that stuff is there in the sea you're swimming through. It might seem big or distant or too big to think about, but it is the sea that your institution is sailing through, and it's right here, right now in 2024. So I hope scenarios open people's minds to that possibility of change, which is much closer than we expected, even though it feels far away.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly we find that with when we do sort of member workshops and on scenarios, that sort of leaving aside the creativity and just the fun it can be just to think about those kinds of things and get that time, that luxury to step away from that front line and dealing with those breaches and those other incidents day to day, just sort of think bigger. But I think it does give them some useful context as well. Because I've just been thinking about sort of, in the UK, we had the recent general election. And before that, politics was dominating. It was just, I could not get away from it. And it was rather quite wearing. But now I don't look at the sort of political news so much because it feels like it's settled down a bit. Whereas the US is clearly becoming rather sort of fervid, and that election's going to be, part of me just thinks, I want that to be over so I can go back to enjoying nice restaurants and strolling in the countryside and not worrying about and hoping that the adults are in charge and things are just, but I'm fooling myself. And I think, I don't know, Sophie, if that's sort of part of it as well. I guess that's, you know, we've alluded to this, that it's about which values you want to preserve and where you need to head as well, just so, yeah, what you need to work towards as much as anything else.
I think that's right. It is about what values you want to preserve, but I think it's also recognizing that you can't control every element of the future either. And I think you touched on it earlier when you were asking about sort of your climate change and is that going to be the catalyst of the future? And I think there's probably a lot of civilizations that have come before us that didn't think, that thought they'd be around forevermore, but actually ended up being adversely affected. And whether it was, those who lived at Angkor Wat or, Machu Picchu, I think more recent studies have shown that in fact, that was what probably led to their demise. And so I think some of these things we may not believe in climate change, or I think increasingly people do, or we may not think it will shape our future in the way that it will. But I think it's quite likely that there are other things that aren't yet on our horizon and that may not have appeared in these scenarios that will shape our future. But it's really how society reacts to those things and
shapes. Yeah, and I think it's all about organisations, like you say, playing their part and just sort of contributing to that discussion as well. I think that's, I think for a lot of organisations, again, sort of member organisations, they... each scenario is useful because it does help them, like you say, Matt, recognize their role in some of this, and they're not disconnected, and that they, it's a sea they swim in, but they have a sort of a course to plot as well, and a lot, and they can take a lot some other people with them too, when it's not just all about them.
I completely agree, and one of the things I was reflecting on is, we talked about CrowdStrike at the top of this conversation, but like back in February, the Australian telecommunications provider Telstra, some of its servers had a problem, which meant that about 100, 150 emergency services calls didn't go through, including a case involving a cardiac arrest where someone lost their life. And Telstra ended up having to apologize because of this. And I think Sophie might have some more detail and nuance on this. I read the story in The Guardian some time ago, so I could just see Sophie's face and now we've got some more detail. But the notion...
I was just going to jump in that, and say it's actually Optus, not Telstra.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But you're quite right. A large telecommunications provider, you are otherwise perfectly correct.
So just to go from the top of that paragraph then to save us having that correction in the podcast. Back in February, an Australian telecommunications provider had problems with its servers, which meant more than 100 emergency services calls didn't go through, including a case where somebody had a cardiac arrest and they actually died. So you had a telecommunications provider having to apologize to this family and to the emergency services. If I'm running ambulances, I'm thinking about emergency healthcare, or I might be thinking about traffic, logistics. Now I am having to think about the fact that I'm part of a networked world. And InfoSec can only be so much of what a paramedic thinks about or their managers think about in a day-to-day. So I think it is about that whole of society response to these uncertainties.
Yeah, I think so. But I think as well, the certainly for information security, it's at a really interesting place and point in its history, because I think it is acknowledging it has a bigger role to play and is trying to live up to that in some respects. But there's a lot of people who... I don't want to say I haven't quite got it yet, but it sort of are very much about get the controls in place, the technical controls in place, and everything will be fine. And that's true to an extent, but there's a lot more work that needs to be done. And some of that is to do with attitude. Some of that to do with, governance, Sophie. And it's just, sort of how you conduct yourself and how you pass on some of those good habits as well. So I think, yeah, it's becoming a bigger, but also I think the, you know, what InfoSec is good at is thinking about risk. And like I say, coping with uncertainty and doing something about it, that resilience, be it one way or another. I don't know if Sophie, that's, again, that sort of thinking about what's next for Audr on this, and just the outcomes from this. Is it changing the organization? Is there sort of some, I guess you do have quite a long sort of gaze towards the future, but yeah, just what's the impact of the scenario work?
Thank you, Mark. I think it's definitely shaped thinking. And in fact, there's been a lot of discussions about how it changes the way you look at everything and probably forever, and whether that's the way you consume the news in the morning. I mean, even today I was looking at, you know, there's so many articles about climate change, you know, whether it be typhoons in Japan and flooding in India and Bangladesh and Australia. We're still in winter, well, only for another few days here, but we've just had our highest recorded temperatures in winter for, you know, ever. And I think that just led me back to scenarios and thinking maybe that ecological civilization scenario will happen sooner than we think, or some of those elements. So as I said, it's very much changed the way we think, not just about our organization now and the short-term challenges in writing that five-year strategy, but it's changed the way we engage with our stakeholders. It's changed the conversations we have with them. And I think those changes are indelible.
Yeah, I think for a lot of organizations who've gone through the scenario work, I think they do try to include more of their stakeholders. So it isn't just the InfoSec unit department capability. It's across that organization. And I guess, Matt, that's sort of, again, that's the sort of reason for doing it, isn't it? It's sort of trying to make sure everybody understands what's at stake.
I think it's one of the benefits of a community like the ISF membership is precisely in times of uncertainty, you kind of stabilize that to some extent by kind of joining hands with others. You know, if you're in a sea of uncertainty, the best thing to do is kind of lash the rafts together to some extent. But even I was thinking about what Sophie was saying, because we've talked a lot about the climate aspect in these scenarios, which means that's what's in the vision of our spotlight, the three of us. But actually, it's the other things in the corner of your vision as well. I look at the Telegram chief being arrested in France, and I think it was like he was betting on something like Audr's Price is Right scenario, where actually private actors, big tech, can do what they want. They don't have to obey regulation, and if people sanction them, they can ignore it. Whereas France feels like it's trying to push the needle more towards a national security-based state of alert scenario, where actually our security concerns trump your ability to be a multinational or transnational entity. So you can see people have different ideas of the future in their head. They're steering towards them because they think they're going to arrive, or they think they can make them arrive. And then somehow we're like a canoeist shooting the rapids. We have some control, some agency, but never fully master everything, because, you know, none of us are omnipotent, right? We can't wave a magic wand to get exactly what we want. So there's something about which futures are we betting on, implicitly or explicitly.
Yeah, but I think it'd be quite dangerous if we all had magic wands. Heavens, what would happen then? The way the world would change. Power in the hand of the wrong people, what could possibly go wrong?
That's so true, Mark, though. I think that was what I found interesting in this, in involving the scenarios too, is that some people really do want that magic wand, and they find that swimming in that sea of uncertainty so disquieting. They really don't enjoy it and swim as hard as they can to get to the other side.
Yeah, but I think, again, sort of, I suppose the, because I'm definitely in those waters up to my neck, if you see what I mean, because I watch the news a lot, and with communications as well, you sort of, that news just gets overwhelming sometimes. But equally, I think the scenario work does give you a sense of calm about it, that you, because you see it day to day, and you think the waters are always going to be choppy, and, you know, like you say, it's sort of, so where do we steer for? And I think that's the real value of this stuff, is that you aren't kidding yourself that things are going to get, the water's going to be calm, and, you know, there's no clouds in the sky and it's all sunny. I think, you like you say, Matt, and I guess you're quite level-headed about these things, and you know, sort of, has that helped you sort of weather some of these problems and the stresses that they can inflict upon you?
It's a good question. There's a well-known American psychotherapist called Irving Yalom, who did group therapy. He pioneered group therapy with people who had terminal diagnoses. And somebody said to him once, this is incredibly anxious work, because you know it is about people facing end of life. And yet you go into a room with a group of these people, and somehow you enable them to have quite difficult conversations. And they said, so does it make it easier for you? How did you do it? And he said, well, look, I was always an anxious kind of guy. So when I went into the room and it was very anxious, I was like, fine, I know this. So I think sometimes it's like that. What I was wondering, when you were talking about magic wands and you were talking about science fiction earlier, because I know you're a fan of this kind of writing and everything else. Mark, what leapt out for you when you saw these scenarios as someone who, as you say, swims in these same seas of uncertainty? Was there stuff with you where there was moments of wonder, moments of shock, moments of like, oh, I haven't seen that before? What stood out for you about the Outer scenarios?
I guess there was, I think I mentioned when I first saw them that I kind of feel I'd read some of those in some science fiction, but equally it just sort of dialed it up a bit as well. So I think it was just the way things could go and how far as well, and just sort of those overriding forces that, and because I like to say, I think it's that the main thing was it connected very closely to where I am now, rather than sort of have that gap between now and the future. I could see the continuum, and I think that was really useful because it certainly grounded it and sort of I can see which way things might go. And I think that was one of the great things about those scenarios, Sophie, is just that they do acknowledge the present and that they're a really good extrapolation. You can sort of see how things might go. And I suppose there's hints, straws in the wind of that, some of that now. And I guess, again, that's the sort of value of the work, is just to try and get people to appreciate some of those, some dangerous directions they might go, but equally the useful and instrumental directions they might go as well. It's sort of, yeah, you can steer these things. And again, it's sort of that, like you say, Matt, becoming familiar with and not happy with that anxious place we all live these days, but just getting better at dealing with it. So just to close off the discussion then, Sophie, I don't know, are you happier about the future now, the way it might go? Is that been part of, is it a kind of therapeutic process as much as anything else to go through these?
Oh, Matt, I so deeply enjoyed the process. I'm not sure if I'm happier about it personally, but from a professional, from a work perspective, I just think it was invaluable. And it certainly allows, I think, Outer as an organisation and the team at Outer to face it with a little bit more confidence, or that we have the tools to navigate those challenges and opportunities. I think it was a great framework through which the team can consider our future and our future strategy creation as well. So, so I think I do face the future with more confidence.
How about you, Matt? Have you sort of got a smile on your face, or are you, let's say, building a bunker? Back to that.
I think it's about being clear-eyed about the limits of your agency, which includes the possibility that you can do more than you think, but you're not necessarily going to get exactly what you want. So that sense of not being affronted if the future doesn't align with just what I wished it to be, but also recognizing that I do have some choice, influence, and control. And I think even you sort of hinted at this with things you were saying before about, you know, grown-ups in the room and politics. You know, actually, for some people, they thought the grown-ups were in the room at the end of the Cold War, and yet the choices made at the fall of the Soviet Union have had an impact on the geopolitics we have today. You might look back and say, if you're doing scenarios in the 1990s, are we a bad scenario from the perspective of 1990? And did the who seemed to be the grown-ups in the room in 1990, did they really make good choices? You know, that's always the question. And I think that notion of, you know, it's like looking for your keys. You lose your keys in the dark and you search for them under the light from the lamppost. Actually, what is beyond that circle of light? That we all think we're looking in the right place, but actually we're just looking where we can. And I think being comfortable with the idea that there is darkness and we can do something about it, but not everything. That's where hope lies for me.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the profound point about here. Like you say, you'll see where you're going and hope for what you might get and then prepare for what you might not. I think that's a sort of, yeah, where scenarios can definitely take us. So there is some hope there. And I think it is that familiarity with these choppy waters as well, sort of coping with that. But I've really enjoyed this discussion. I always do. It's always a great sort of, you know, thinking about the future. I love those kind of things. Thanks to Matt. Thanks, Sophie. And thanks to everybody for listening. We covered a lot of ground, but some really, really good stuff there. And I think thanks, Sophie, for taking the time, because I know it's the end of your day.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, tell your colleagues, get everyone to listen to this. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Just search for Dear InfoSec, where you get your podcasts, or look for our page on Audioboom, where you can subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.